Okay, I'm going to be try to run the trains on time this morning because we have a lot going on. So, yeah. Morning, Steve. Okay, everyone. Good morning. We're going to get started because we're going to try to cover not one, not two, not three, but five bureaus this morning. So brevity will be the soul of wit when it comes to both presentations and council discussion. So with that, we'll turn it over to Kurt to start the presentation, unless, Andrew, you have anything preliminary before we get going? Okay. You're on.
Very good. Thank you, Mayor. My name is Kurt Krieger, Housing Bureau Director. With me today is Sarah Zahn, the chair of our Budget Advisory Committee and the Portland Housing Advisory Commission. We have one open seat because we're going to have some people cycle into the open seat. And just by way of prior introduction, Dyke Dame, a member of the executive committee of the PHAC, and a BAC member is here, as well as the senior staff of the Bureau. So we have a PowerPoint slide to briefly provide you an overview with, so I'd like to spool that up. Excellent. We wanted to at least provide an overview of the Bureau's activities. I think you've got a print version. And this draws heavily on materials we provided to the state legislature as they were debating housing policy this last session. So over 208, let me back up the... About 257,000 households are in the city of Portland. About half, just under 50%, or 125,000, are renter households. We think about 23,000 of those are affordable units, including the 13,600 or so that are permanently affordable, funded by the Housing Bureau. And the other units are owned either by developers that have received HUD subsidies or mortgage insurance or Home Forward. So of those renter households, 66% are considered low income, earning less than 80% of the median income for the area. And for a family of three, that's about $58,800. Amongst renter households, however, 30% of those receive less than $20,000 per annum, which is roughly a full-time minimum wage worker in Oregon under our current minimum wage laws. And as you know, and as has been reaffirmed by Kay Schiller again yesterday, Portland continues to lead the country in housing cost increases, both rental housing cost increases and home ownership. And by the way, that's not projected to end anytime soon. We were projected in January to lead the country for the entire calendar year. And there's nothing on the economic horizon that would disprove that forecast. So we have some challenges ahead of us, and one of those, I think, is renter affordability generally. We did a data scrape of all the new units placed into service in 2015, and the average rent was $1,954. So the rent per annum, about $23,448, with utilities pretty close to $25,000. So a full-time minimum wage worker earning some $1,603 per month before taxes would be spending approximately 80% of their income for that average rental property. So no wonder people are doubled up, tripled up in rental accommodations. And I would add parenthetically that home ownership is even worse. The price of admission, of course, with current underwriting standards is quite high. And many of the concerns that you see expressed in the budget have been presented to us by the East Portland Action Plan and other advocates. So you see budget targets, goals, new programs proposed in East Portland to help ameliorate the gentrification that's ongoing. Let me provide a graphic portrayal of that. In the State of Housing 2015, we published in October, we track affordability by neighborhood. And this shows you rent increases in the last 12 months as of last fall, indexing three-person renter affordability. So at 30% of median family income, which would be about $20,000 per annum, there's no neighborhood in the city that would be affordable to you. If you happen to be employed at 60% of the median family income, about $40,000 for a household of three, the very far north corner of the city and the very far eastern edge of the city is still affordable. And at 80% of median family income, about half the city is affordable. And I must say that as we were doing the final state of housing report, neighborhoods fell out of affordability between the time that the draft was prepared in spring of 2015 and the final was prepared in October of 2015. So the velocity is rapidly moving. And it has even more profound effect on racial equity and inclusion. The next slide talks about three-person households of different ethnicities. And as you can see, the white households and the Asian households are very closely mirroring one another, the two graphics, one on the left, one on the right. And they track the 80% of MFI affordability. However, African-American households are priced out of the city. Latino households, except for one neighborhood in the far eastern edge of the city, are priced out, and Native Americans are priced out. And what you know is that there is a diaspora going on, that people of color are being displaced from historically black neighborhoods and neighborhoods that were often portal neighborhoods where economic opportunities were plentiful and there was a range of housing choices. And those individuals are now often forced to move far from transit, far from jobs, and have to move their children out of their preferred schools. So many of our affordable housing interventions on the program side are to try to ameliorate that trend. Home ownership is still a vital and important part of what we do. About 80% of the production of housing within the city is actually rental, but ownership still is an important tool to build family wealth and to stabilize neighborhoods. And you'll see in the budget several measures that have to do with promoting home ownership. And based on last year's budget, we've launched the North Northeast Housing Investment Strategy, and some $5 million was allocated to a consortia of neighborhood-based community development corporations which serve communities of color with home ownership products. We're also looking at further land banking, and you will see in the budget the securitization of the short-term rental revenue, which is an attempt to provide housing resources outside of urban renewal areas. And I think it would be good to hear from Sarah about that transformation, because in the past, we served urban renewal areas, some 12 urban renewal areas. In the future, our aim is to serve the entire city. And with the guidance of the PHAC, we're in that process. Sarah, would you like to speak to that issue?
Good morning. My name is Sarah Zahn, and I'm the chairperson of the Portland Housing Advisory Commission and also of the Budget Advisory Commission. And I'm really happy to be here this morning to talk to you about the Portland Housing Bureau's budget and their priorities. I think that we have a sort of interesting time and opportunity in the city as it pertains to housing and what we can do. Between the declaration of a housing crisis and some new opportunities with funding sources for the city, I think we're poised to make an impact on some of the statistics that Kurt has shared with you this morning. Since I became the chairperson of the advisory commission, we've done a couple of really key things to address the housing crisis, including facilitating a lift on the tax increment financing from the PDC budget from 30% to 45% dedicated to housing. And as the advisory commission, we're really proud of that effort and proud of the significant resources it will bring to rental housing over the next several years. But as Kurt said, that still restricts us within the urban renewal areas where those dollars are available. So one of the things that the advisory commission is really focused on is citywide resources and our ability to do some new things with our budget. At the state level, as you all know, we recently worked to lift the preemption on inclusionary housing. So in this next budget cycle, the Housing Bureau will be taking a lot of time to look at how those rules will be implemented and some of the tools we can put in place to use inclusionary housing as one of our tools to increase affordability in the rental market here in Portland. So I know Kurt is going to give you some more information about that moving forward, but I think that our advisory commission right now really is a strong representation of a number of different groups and factions within the city, ranging from private market developers like Dyke and myself to our housing advocates and those who represent a number of different constituencies in the city. So we are enthusiastic about the work to be done by the Bureau. This is a big budget this year, and we feel it's really appropriate given the housing crisis that we're facing here in the city at this time.
So I think it would be appropriate at this time to invite Dyke Dame to join us. My first day on the job, August 10th, was the week after the Portland Housing Advisory Commission had voted to recommend that you increase, as a council, the proportion of tax income and financing from 30% to 45 to 50%. And I believe Dyke was actually the maker of the motion and was a very forceful advocate for that change. And that followed then, as Sarah mentioned, a very concerted effort to work in the legislature. And I must commend that Dyke and Sarah both were in Salem many times. They sacrificed their business ventures and set aside their personal time to advocate for the city of Portland's top legislative priority. And Dyke being a private developer and Sarah being a private developer were both very salient, and their message was well heard in Salem. Dyke, would you like to speak to the inclusionary housing issue?
I always need a lot of help, technologically incompetent as I am. First, I'm Dyke Dame, Williams and Dame Development. My partner would be here, but he recently had back surgery, so he's in bed and trying to get off oxy right now. Appreciate the opportunity to speak with you, and also the opportunity that you have provided me to serve on the PHAC group. I've met lots of new people. I've come to understand issues that I should have understood better. And I think it's important for all of us in private enterprise to participate in these kinds of things. Particularly interesting for me to go to Salem. I'd never been to a sausage factory before. And so I really enjoyed that process to meet many of the senators and have an opportunity to interact with them. So that was great.
And you added some unique spice to that.
I think, as you all know, the governor has a signing ceremony for inclusionary zoning on Friday down at Gray's Landing, and I think that's a very important event. As Sarah so aptly pointed out, and as did Kurt, this should enable the city to expand its affordable housing activities beyond urban renewal districts. We do need to keep in mind, though, that it's a bit of an experiment, right, for us. It's done in other cities. We haven't done it here. And so we've got to keep in mind that we will need to be flexible. There may need to be changes as we go down the road. And so many of you have heard the Dyke speech before, which is the world runs on arithmetic. And unless we can make stuff pencil, we're going to have a problem. I think with the efforts of the Housing Bureau and good attitudes of private developers that people will be able to make this happen. But again, we need to be mindful of the fact that we're going to have to be flexible. There may have to be a tweak or two. It was very interesting when Sarah and I were in Salem, a number of the senators, Republicans I might add, who voted for this, surprisingly enough in some cases, said, "We know you'll be back." And that resonated with me because we know that it's not perfect. And we also have to be mindful of unintended consequences here. So I think there is a great staff at the Housing Bureau. I know they're going to do a good job. And those of us like Sarah and myself that are on the advisory committee are looking forward to working with the staff and making this happen.
So just to articulate more fully, we've been doing inclusionary housing for over 20 years, and the River District is probably the best case in point. It's voluntary, and in large part because of the city's investment, the PDC's investment in infrastructure, we were able to obtain quid pro quo affordable housing. Over 30% of the housing in the River District is permanently affordable as a result of those development agreements. And we've achieved similar results, perhaps not quite as quickly or as dramatic, in other urban renewal areas. So what we're trying to do is to move beyond the voluntary inclusion, where we're essentially paying to get affordable units, to tap the hydraulics of the private sector and to leverage private capital to attain public goals. That will require us to recalibrate and align all of our tools to work in concert with one another. And I think that's Dyke's point about making sure that we don't shift costs onto private developers that render projects infeasible, but we incentivize their behavior to produce the best possible outcome for the community. The range of programs that we're looking at is to look at the multi-unit limited tax exemption, which you've capitated at $3 million a year. We're on track to expend all that money, and I'm pleased that we're seeing a good geographic distribution of projects using the multi. The Senate Bill 1533 that was passed by the legislature says that we can require up to 20% affordable housing within projects over 20 units, and that the income level would be 80% of median income or above. The bill also gives local governments, cities and counties, the ability to levy construction excise tax on both residential and commercial development to help fund the offsetting cost of compliance. So we could offer tax exemptions, we could offer STC waivers, we could offer bonus density incentives, non-cash, non-capital incentives such as priority permit processing. The new Type 2X design review would constitute one of those. And we can buy down through direct financing the affordability of those units. So while the legislature established a benchmark of 80% of AMI, we won't be satisfying our social equity goals, our inclusion goals at that level. We need to be willing to invest more deeply into projects as appropriate. So we want to make sure that all the financial tools are recalibrated and aligned to the greatest possible effect. So we have a lot of work ahead of us, and we will come forward in the June specifically with measures to begin implementing the bill. The actual inclusionary housing policies can't go into effect until December. So there's quite a lot of work to be done in the next 6 months. With respect to homelessness, are there any questions about inclusionary zoning, perhaps, before we get into homeless issues? Because I don't want to pivot too quickly on this issue. Very good. An essential part of what we do is to serve the people in desperate need of housing and shelter in the city of Portland. And you as a council have dedicated an enormous amount of general fund resources as recently as last week to help end homelessness.
Sorry, Kurt, let me do interrupt you with this one. I'm going to ask the Planning Bureau the same question. So the legislature's acted, the law's in place, we have a comp plan underway that may or may not need to be adjusted to reflect the reality of the new authority. I ask Susan the same question. But is there staff assigned and budget allocated to doing the work to put the tool in place?
We have a spring bump request of about $80,000 to address that issue.
Okay. The Housing Bureau?
The
or
Housing
both
Bureau.
Bureaus?
The Housing Bureau has a. I transmitted it yesterday to the CBO, and it's. We think it's a very realistic, modest request. We're adding one policy analyst to support Matthew Scheibold, our policy and equity manager, in this effort. We also have some. We had previously procured the services of David Rosen and Associates with Eco Northwest as a subconsultant to do the evaluation necessary for the so-called linkage fee. That scope of work has been modified slightly to include the calibration of construction excise taxes in different districts of the city. And since Eco Northwest was the prime contractor to PDC and the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability for the mixed-use zoning effort, the same typologies that were assumed in that modeling effort will be assumed in the inclusionary housing effort. So we're building on the previous policy work of planning and sustainability.
So are you changing the consulting scope of work in the budget as well, or just?
Yes, both the scope and the schedule have been modified. And to the tune of about $50,000. So about $50,000 of our requests related to the scope and schedule. There is 2 months of staff time in the spring bump, and there's some meeting hosting. We want to engage a full range of stakeholders, so we have some meeting hosting expenses in the spring bump.
So that's a really good question, and a follow-up one is whether the increase in intensity of use or the upzoning that we're going to be providing would count as the incentive for inclusionary housing to be required.
Indeed, it is intended to be so. Joe Zender and Matthew Scheibold have been working very closely. The Housing Bureau and Planning and Sustainability have met several times, specifically on Central City bonus density incentives and the mixed-use zoning classifications and the housing incentives in the budget. Susan Anderson and I met yesterday afternoon again on the very subject. So I'd say the synchronicity between the two bureaus, in this case the three bureaus, because PDC is actually funding the modeling effort for the mixed-use zoning efforts, has been quite close.
All kinds of interesting things. There it goes. Yeah, but I've posed the same set of questions and tasks to Susan, and I don't think we're there yet. I think we have work to do and recalibration to do in the comp plan itself, as well as making sure that, you know, the programmatic stuff is in place. I won't claim to have figured it all out, but I've asked people who work for us to figure it out for us. But what's the upside of density that we offer? How do we offer it and when?
Yep.
It's different now than it was with multi, because it isn't voluntary. It's going to be a required ingredient. And so we want to make it worth people's while, as Dyke accurately pointed out. It's got a pencil. The math has to work. So we have to make sure our math accommodates that math.
Yeah, but we don't have to give any upzoning at all. So
we have to give that. We have to give some betterment.
No.
The statute.
We may or may not be planning to increase the density for other reasons.
I get you. Right.
Yeah. So right. I want to make sure that it.
We don't want to bless people with the gift before we require
exactly.
the reciprocity.
And well, I have a question actually for our developer partners.
Please.
When you say something has to pencil, what's the level of profit margin that you factor into to make it pencil?
Part of it depends where the money comes from, right? Because most of the apartments that are being built here, the money is coming from institutional investors who are located in lots of different places in the United States, right? And so depending upon what their horizon is in terms of their investment criteria, whether it's a long-term hold, they see it as a short-term hold, those are all different numbers. So there's no one size that fits all.
I'll just add to that Girding Edlin has an equity fund that we're deploying nationally. And to date, we haven't used it in Portland because we haven't been able to achieve the returns required by the particular pot of money that we have to deploy in other cities in Portland. So that's a fairly aggressive investment strategy that's associated with that fund. But I think, you know, as we are examining placing more requirements on developers through inclusionary zoning, you know, it's important to understand where the money to fund projects is coming from. In our case, we would look at other sources for Portland-based projects that have a slightly lower rate of return requirement and tend to be, as Dyke pointed out, a slightly longer kind of threshold for, you know, getting a return that's required.
So potentially if the council were to create a pot of money that we would expect to get paid back, unlike some of the loans which we don't expect to get paid back, we could undercut what the for-profit banks are charging and make things more affordable. Then in that case, aside from what the outside lenders require, what's the profit margin for the companies, actually, the construction companies and the developers actually doing the projects here?
I mean, I think it ranges, you know, from in our experience from, you know, 8 to 15%.
That's probably fair. We're, neither Sarah nor I work for a construction company, and your question asked about contractors. And I don't know anything about margins for construction companies. But I think the range that Sarah described, depending upon the source of the money, you know, for example, let's just use an illustration. There are union pension for their people who represent union pension funds. In order to generate those union construction jobs, they will often make an investment or a loan at a slightly lower rate than someone else might have who doesn't have the same objective or the same goal as part of their overall program. So it varies.
I'm just thinking that might be a place to look as well, that for most investments that I can make with the amount of money that I have, I'm not getting 8 to 15%. And if we can make the developer or construction company profit more like 8% rather than 15%, that would tend, and I don't know what incentives there might be or other mechanisms to encourage that.
We're going to find out if Kurt and his company can do that.
In what?
We're going to find out if Kurt and company can do that.
The National Association of Home Builders does publish profit and overhead norms for the industry, but they tend to aggregate urban infill developers along with greenfield single-family home builders. And so it's you almost have to unwind that industry to be able to look at specific niches. What I would say is that many developers, especially large-scale developers, will invest in park improvements, street improvements, sanitary sewer and water improvements before they actually get a return. So that 3 to 5 year upfront investment is highly at risk because they can often miss the business cycle. So part of the range of return is to help compensate them for what is essentially out of pocket with no return for the first 3 to 5 years. I'd say that smaller developers have less in capital deployed and therefore their risk ratio and return would be less. And urban developers have to deal with, as Sarah is doing at First and Arthur, with remediation of hazardous materials and some of the site preparation costs that are inherent to an urban site. So I think the range is worth noting, but there is a risk-reward ratio that is always going to be maintained, and if they can't make a reasonable return in development, they'll put it someplace else, capital being the most mobile resource available.
I'll just say one more thing, and that is that when we, right now Girding Yulin is working with the multi-program in a project, and we have worked in inclusionary other cities that have inclusionary requirements, and we do look at those percentage of units as a risk mitigation. So I think there is some level of strategy around looking at 20% of units, for example, or 10% of units at a lower rental level as a risk mitigation in a marketplace where we are more subject to business cycles. So there is some level of expectation that there's a benefit to the project around you know, those lower rents.
And maybe to sum up this conversation, Matthew Scheibold within the Bureau has done some modeling. We looked at the Bureau Development Services pipeline for the last 5 years, which of course includes the tail end of the recession and now the full recovery. And we projected the unit production experienced in the last 5 years forward for 20 and used the rubric that is in Senate Bill 1533 of 20% of the units over of every project over 20 units in size to be able to project what we might be able to attain through inclusionary zoning. It's about 4,600 units. So the conversation that many people had, which is this by itself is not a magic bullet. It doesn't solve all of our problems. It solves a spectrum of our need. We have some, the comp plan has 10,000 units forecast for permanently affordable new units. And then we have a present day need of about 23,000 units. So we have a universe of need of pretty close to 35,000 units. And inclusionary zoning will get us partway there, but not entirely there. And of that need, we have different income spectrums. 0 to 30, we would have to buy down deeply. We don't expect to get a lot of 0 to 30% units through inclusionary zoning. We think that's still going to require the direct investment of the Bureau with our legacy partners and our private private development partners in the community. So with respect to homelessness, a important part of the safety net in Portland is the range of homeless services from safety on the streets to permanent supportive housing. And you will see in the budget request a concerted effort with respect to tenant protections and additional tenant services, as well as permanent supportive housing for people with incomes between 0 and 30% of the median income. And in this particular budget cycle, we were responding to the initiatives of Home for Everyone to try to cue our budget to the county's budget. Only our budget came out about 2 months prior to the county budget. So we had to make certain policy assumptions about cost share of different programs. And as you will see, that we're essentially sharing costs of about 50-50. As we are structuring the migration of homeless service contracts that are currently provided by the city to the office of the county board chair. That said, we as a housing bureau will continue to provide tenant protection services and expanded tenant protections, and we will continue to be the lead on permanent supportive housing. So there's a carefully balanced package of ads that Sally Erickson is able to speak to, as well as Mark Jolin with Home for Everyone, who are both present. I would say that we have focused intently on people of color in the last 12 months, because as you, I'm sure, certainly aware that the last 3 years, we noticed about a 58% increase in homelessness amongst people of color, especially single African-American men. There was nearly a 20% increase amongst homelessness among women that were unaccompanied. So many of the current efforts, the so-called Sears shelter for women, the so-called Peace shelter that was opened on Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, specifically low barrier shelters for people that were otherwise unserved by our current system. So we've attempted to respond as rapidly as possible. We now need throughput. We need places for these people to go so that they have indeed permanent supportive housing to be successful. And that's embedded in the budget as well. The last thing I'd like to say with our available time is that we have been meeting weekly with Marissa Madrigal and the staff of the county on a creation of a joint office of homeless services. This is not a divestiture of responsibility. This is a concerted effort to help create some system efficiencies. Instead of the county and the city jointly funding some of the same nonprofits, we hope to have a more unitary approach. We are also on track to migrate some 4 city staff people to county employment on July 1. There may be delays along the way. The intergovernmental agreement is currently being negotiated. I believe on the 12th of April, the entire council will be meeting with the Board of Commissioners in this regard. So some of the governance questions that you might have, I think, will be able to be explored in depth at that time. Be happy to respond to any other questions you might have specifically about the budget.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Jessica Kennard. I'm a principal analyst at the City Budget Office. Here with me is Jane Marie Ford, also an analyst. Together, we worked on the Housing Bureau's budget. So in recognition of the declared housing state of emergency, as well as the intent of council to fund an additional $20 million in housing and homeless services, CBO recommendations include just over $28 million in new discretionary funding for housing and homeless services, which includes the $5 million in new ongoing and $5 million in new one-time general fund support for housing and homeless services, which council allocated last fall. CBO is also recommending an additional $3.7 million in one-time homeless services funding, and the Bureau is also proposing $14.4 million in affordable housing funding, development funding, through the securitization of the new short-term rental revenue funding stream. In addition, the budget includes newly appropriated affordable housing development funds as a result of the TIF lift, and up to $30 million of TIF lift funds may be made available through ANOFA or other community process in next year's budget. So in total, we are exceeding, through CBO recommendations at least, we're exceeding that $20 million threshold. Given the limited resources and the magnitude of the challenge, CBO really focused on data and performance outcomes when evaluating these requested budgets. I want to note that PHB Bureau staff have really done an excellent job in recent years establishing and tracking the outcomes in relation to the target populations that they want to serve, as well as the performance outcomes that they want to see. In addition, the Home for Everyone Coordinating Board has a data and evaluation subcommittee that has city staff and county staff sitting on it, and that they have developed together a performance monitoring and report plan with key performance metrics that will track the progress of these investments and report back quarterly on a quarterly basis on the impact of these investments. So CBO considered the impact of the all the investments in relation to these established metrics when we were proposing our recommendations. As Director Krieger mentioned, or as mentioned in the slideshow, the Home for Everyone target goal was to decrease by half the unmet housing need among people experiencing homelessness by June of 2017, so the end of this fiscal year. To do this, the Home for Everyone stated it needed to achieve 650 additional placements, safety off the street placements, 1,350 permanent placements, 1,000 preventions or diversions, as well as an additional $10 million in affordable housing development. Of these services, on the service side, the city was expected to provide half of the required services. So CBO recommendations tended to focus a little more on the prevention side than what was put forth just by AHFE. We evaluated several budget proposals, not just from a Home for Everyone and from the Bureau, but also other city bureaus. In total, I'm happy to go into more detail if you like. Our recommendations would be estimated to yield up to 490 more homelessness preventions than the Home for Everyone goals. However, our recommendations are shy of meeting the Home for Everyone safety off the streets targets by about 100 placements, and shy of rapid rehousing targets by about 30, although our recommendations do include slightly more permanent supportive housing placements than what was recommended.
So those net,
I was trying to put our recommendations in relation to the Home for Everyone targets.
Right, but if we prevent more, then we don't need as many shelter or rehousing, right? So does your recommendation keep more people off the street or not?
Yes. Supposedly that more people would be prevented from becoming homeless. The challenge is identifying at this point in time how many people are going to become homeless in the next year. So I think that there was an estimate of inflow from the 2015 point in time count of approximately just under 5,000 a year would become homeless. But that was from data in January of 2015, and as Director Krieger mentioned, we know that affordable housing and rents have gone up quite a bit since then. So I would expect that inflow into the homeless system would have increased in the past year, and it may continue to increase. So it's part of the reason why we focused a little bit more on prevention. It's not a one-for-one. It's not necessarily saying that those individuals on the street won't need safety off the street placements, but yes, the thinking is that by preventing more people from becoming homeless, you would need to then do less interventions once people become homeless.
Mayor, I see we've blocked us 55 minutes for discussion, so I appreciate that. If I could indulge my colleagues for a few minutes, I'll just pose some questions.
I have more I can say, but this is your work session.
No, go ahead.
All right, so I just wanted to briefly provide an overview of the general fund historical support for the Bureau. So in recent years, we've increased, the city has increased its general fund support from about 5 years ago in 2011-12 from $11 million to $17.3 million in the current year. Now, general fund support for the Bureau has fluctuated over the last 15 years. The prior peak was in, I believe it was in 2007-08, and it was $14.3 million. So by all accounts, the Bureau request for $40 million this next year is a new peak, a new level of general fund support. CBO does not disagree with this new level of support. I think it's it is responsive to the current need and the current housing crisis, but we just would encourage council to continue to focus on clearly articulating your goals around investments and tracking and measuring the progress, utilizing the networks and the established measures that the Bureau and Home for Everyone have set up to make sure that every dollar that we're spending is getting the effective results that we want to see. Now I'm done.
So I guess we're scheduled till 10:15, so we're going to have a robust discussion. And I have a bunch of questions, Kurt. Some are just to pose them and ask for a follow-up. Others are maybe one-sentence answers. If they go beyond a one-sentence answer, let's schedule some follow-up time because I want everyone to have a chance to. First of all, I love this, your PowerPoint. And we all struggle with developing PowerPoints. Some bureaus are heavy on data, others in pie charts and lots of information. You've told a story. And the part that I love about your PowerPoint is you've highlighted about six or seven things that you and Dan have done in the last 6 months that have been transformative. And congratulations to both of you. And you really frame the problem. 23,000 units, and if you are very poor, you cannot live in this city. And if you're very poor, you're likely also to be a person of color and you can no longer live in Portland. So I think what you've done is you've focused our attention on what the problem is and you've challenged us to align our resources with the problem. And I think there's been a tradition around housing of sometimes overreaching and trying to be all things to all people. We can't do that because we just don't have the resources. So we've got to be strategic. And I appreciate the way you frame the data because your data tells us where the problem is and where we should put every last dollar. We cannot just make small bets all over the place because there's a crushing need at the low end. So here's some questions. Number one, can you, after this forum, just follow up and let us know, give us like a cheat sheet of where does your budget request deviate from the Home for Everyone package? So if there's something that Home for Everyone is framed and it's not in your budget package, could you highlight that for us and just explain why? And if it's all in your package, that's fine. But I haven't been able to go through and track line by line.
I'd be happy to. I think it might be more useful to do that in context of the chair's budget because Home for Everyone is a recommendation. I'd be happy to flag the areas of divergence, which are very few, frankly, because we started with their recommendations. But more importantly, the county chair's budget, which I believe is, I haven't seen it. I believe it was prepared last Friday, but I've not yet seen the detail of it. I think we'll have it by the 12th. And I think that would be more helpful than just a Home for Everyone portion.
We would love it if the county in some category covered more than their share and gave us more flexibility. So yes, that would be enormously helpful. Number two, by I think resolution, we committed to putting together a committee to help draft the guidelines for our inclusionary housing proposal. Have you made a judgment yet as to who's going to serve on that committee? And if so, can you share that with us? If not, Will the council have an opportunity collectively to weigh in on nominees?
I could probably answer that. We're in the process of recruiting members right now. We'll have from 9 to 12 people, and they'll represent a broad diversity of interests, as we stated in the resolution the council passed that we would do. And they should be up and running shortly.
So on the off chance that any member of council has a suggested nominee, I would just urge you to send out an email and solicit suggestions. We have a couple of people we'd like to pitch. Obviously, it's Dan's call as to the composition. But we've had some people approach us that express an interest. So if we could have a process to share that information with you so you can make your best judgment. The flaw in the inclusionary housing legislation was it's somewhat biased towards 80% and above. But the genius of what you guys did at the end game was to create the flexibility to buy down from 80%. The data in your presentation tells us that 80% and above is nice to have, below 80% is need to have. So one of the things that I'll be looking for in your report is what are those robust tools that we can put in place to buy down to get to where the real need is. Number three, in light of the documented need at 0 to 30, and I think Dan and I both hate using MFI because it's so arid. 30% of median family income and below is a older adult on disability, a full-time minimum wage worker, and a someone who's just out of school starting their first job. That's who they are. So let's put the human face on it. They can't afford to live in our city. And so one of the things that I also appreciate that you've been doing recently, and we'll try to sort of codify this, is in each of your ordinances to council about a spending proposal, you've been quantifying where the units fall within the spectrum and how it offsets our long-term goals. And I think that's helpful for the council to keep a running tally of how are we doing towards these audacious goals you've set. Kurt, you inherited a TIF cliff. We've heard about the, you used the term TIF lift. So, all right, and before Amanda busts me, we're talking about tax increment finance dollars, and council increased the amount of urban renewal money for affordable housing, but we're about to go over a cliff simultaneously, and in some instances, we're probably going to take PDC with us by increasing the amount for housing. Question I have for you is, knowing that that's a finite resource, knowing that we're going through an extraordinary period where we're using general fund resources that we may not have in the future if there's another economic downturn, and knowing that we can't expect Congress to bail us out, I take it that it is your view that we must, with some urgency, find a new revenue source for affordable housing?
Yeah, faced with a TIF cliff, I think you invent a hang glider, and our effort, frankly, and most of my time has been spent on trying to devise means by which we can reduce our reliance on tax increment financing, knowing that we still have robust resources in the interstate urban renewal area. We have a concerted long-range strategy in the River District with respect to the U.S. Postal Service property, whereby the Housing Bureau will have a $20 million investment in return for up to 1,000 units of affordable housing within the 14-acre site. We know that we will have resources in Gateway and in Lentz, but the other urban renewal areas are on a glide path to be decommissioned. So as I look for new ways to serve the entire city, the securitization of short-term rental revenue was a springboard. The commercial excise tax that we talked about is the ultimate, I think, offset for the loss of tax increment financing.
More questions, I can pause for others or keep going. It's your pleasure. Thank you. Kurt, you've given us a preview of a discussion we'll have in a couple weeks about the joint city-county homeless office. I'm reminded that many years ago there was a report talking about a whole menu of options for how we could align and consolidate and sharpen our services, Judy Clegg's report. We bit off a big chunk of that when we consolidated all the city's services and programs under one roof and created the Housing Bureau. Now we're sort of bringing resolution A and B into the conversation, and we're jumping the river. This is going to be an experiment, and there are arguments on both sides of it. What's the revenue? What's the budget impact to the city of creating this joint office?
Well, first, I think it's important to state that the goal is to reduce homelessness by 50% in the next 2 years. This wouldn't otherwise be worth the effort that we're all putting into it. but we are migrating about $15 million of general fund revenue from our budget to the county under this rubric. They would migrate back up to about $2 million of permanent supportive housing resources. The intergovernmental agreement has not yet been finalized. Attorneys for both the county attorney and the city attorney are working in concert on that. And I think you'll be interested in seeing perhaps the outline of it on the 12th. As I said, we're not divesting responsibility. Jennifer Chang, who is currently within the Bureau, would remain as a liaison with respect to managing the intergovernmental agreement. And the same kind of reporting and robust sort of accounting measures that we've taken with all of our providers heretofore will continue. So we'll continue to recognize that this is money appropriated by you on an annual basis and subject to the same level of accountability that it has been in the past.
We can't bind a future council, but it will be, I understand, the expectation that we would continue to maintain a robust level of funding and ship it to the county.
I think their expectation is for some hold harmless protections, which they didn't apparently have in resolutions A and B, the original sort of construct with the county. And I think Marissa Madrigal is particularly concerned about making sure that there is at least some triggers within the agreement that if there is a downturn, that there is a means by which they can be compensated or we can take back primary responsibility as we have had for the last 40 years.
Thank you. Two last questions. Council has made a commitment to increase funding by $20 million. As I understand it, Mayor, $10 million of that was built into the budget as ongoing money. So that was the first down payment and put into the structural budget. That leaves $10 million. We will have, I'm guessing, a discussion about what constitutes new money and under what circumstances could another dollar qualify as an offset or as a contribution towards the 10. Can you walk us through your current thinking of how we get to the other $10
million? Well, I see it as my responsibility to provide an array of options to you. The securitization of the short-term rental revenue was in part to give you some flexibility. Whether or not that money comes from general fund or tax increment or from short-term rental revenue is sort of above my pay grade. I think it's up to three votes of council to decide, frankly, where it comes from. Obviously, TIF money can only be spent in URAs, can only be spent on capital. The other thing that I think is important to underscore is that the short-term rental revenue is to help offset the loss of affordable units as they have been converted to nightly stay accommodations. And one of the things that we're constantly faced with are opportunities outside of urban renewal areas for land acquisition for which we don't have dedicated funding streams. We have been, for example, talking with the Parks Bureau about surplus property. BES has surplus property. And those sites are often not conveniently located in a place where we have tax increment financing. So we do need some flexible funds to take advantage of those opportunities. Cully has been particularly concerned about the loss of mobile home parks in Northeast Portland. They're well outside of the interstate urban renewal area and gateway, and we can only fund those kinds of things with community development block grant funds. And as you rightly note, those are capitated. We're not going to be seeing increases in those funds in the future.
Well, I guess you're right. We have to decide this question. Mayor will take the first cut on it. The commitment was $20 million to address homelessness, and there are some dollars which are better than others, as you've noted, in terms of addressing homelessness, some that are more flexible, some that have a bigger return, and yet we also have a lot of other needs that the council has to fill with the limited one-time and ongoing money. I think what I would appreciate as one of the decision makers is just a little cheat sheet of what are the options for filling that $10 million, starting with what I'm assuming Dan's, and Dan's a good poker player, Dan's first opening play, which might be $10 million, $10 new from the general fund with the greatest flexibility. But then what are some of the other sources that could, with a straight face, be considered applied to the $10 million? I, for one, applaud both of you for taking the first of all, I thank the council for agreeing to take the short-term revenue from Airbnb and dedicating it to a fund, and I applaud you for securitizing, for leveraging that to create a $15 million fund. I'm personally skeptical as to whether that should count against the 10. I can understand why someone might make that argument, but you know, if one were to be very aggressive about this, I think you might say that's separate and we'll take on top of that additional resources. So I think it would be helpful to know what the options are through this budget process, what dollar reasonably could be considered applied to that 10, because at the end of the day, we're going to have to balance limited resources, fungible dollars, and a policy decision about what we meant when we declared a $20 million of new money. The final question I just wanted to ask you has to do with at-risk buildings, at-risk properties, and the city's no net loss policy. And Commissioner Fritz earlier sort of talked about, you know, upstream preventing homelessness versus then addressing homelessness. And the problem we have in all of this is that despite our best intentions, we don't actually control the market and we don't control the economy. So we're making bets, and tomorrow if the economy tanks, our pledged and homelessness is going to become an aspirational goal, and it's unlikely we'll get there if another 5,000 people fall into homelessness. So it's, we don't control some of the key variables, but we can set goals. And I think the question of at-risk properties is a crucial one because we're losing inventory as we're also talking about building. And we used to have a tool called No Net Loss, which lost some of its luster because it was an aspiration without a mechanism to actually implement it. So you could track the loss, but you didn't have a trigger that said it required the council to do something. We have other things in our work where if we build a park, we are required to fund the O&M. That's very intentional. But this is, here's a problem, and we don't have a solution. Do you have any thoughts as to whether there's a son of no net loss that we need to consider that helps your cause and Dan's cause by focusing us on the fact that we need to act when there's an at-risk property and that sets some parameters on that?
I do, and I've spent a lot of time in the last month or two about the Joyce Hotel, which is perhaps the best current example of an endangered building. And just for those folks that aren't deeply embedded in this subject matter, in 2001, the City Council passed resolution 36021 that attempted to maintain no fewer than 8,286 rental housing units affordable to households with incomes between 0 and 60% of the area median within the central city. And at that time, in 2002, when the resolution was passed, those units existed. A recent survey, which was done in October of last year, 2015, 6,594 regulated units and 267 market rate units affordable at 60% of MFI existed in the central city. So literally, we lost about 8,000 units. Now, we added rent regulated units in the central city, which helped ameliorate part of that, but the market affordable units were largely lost. And the Joyce is one of those buildings and the last building for which people can rent on a weekly stay basis, which is terribly important for people that are coming out of perhaps surgery. They need a short-term stay. Palliative care can't be rendered to them on the streets, so a short-term stay of a week is actually really helpful. And we had attempted to acquire the building and to restructure its management with Central City Concern. The owner is apparently has other plans, although the door remains ajar. If they are interested in selling the building, we have made an offer, and that offer is good probably for another 6 weeks or so. But there will come a time where we have to allocate those revenues. The revenues are currently tax increment financing revenues in the South Park Block's URA. And the NOFA, as we are currently underwriting projects, is scheduled to allocate those monies for other projects, new construction projects. But looking forward and learning from this experience, the East Portland Action Plan has advocated quite forcefully that the market affordable units in East Portland are equally important to families and largely large ethnic minority families in East Portland. And the rental rehabilitation program embedded in the budget is a start to help stabilize that building stock and to make it permanently affordable. I've been accurately quoted in the